Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. The podcast you're about to hear was recorded in 2011.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Thrilling Tales. It's nice to see you here today. My name is David. I'm a librarian here on the third floor. I work in the fiction department, so if you're ever looking for something good to read, do come and see us sometime. Thrilling Tales happens usually on the first and third Monday of every month. However, our next Thrilling Tales for this month is not till next month, which is April 4th. We've got a modern story of suspense called Surveillance by Jeffrey Deaver. Sometimes we do recent stories and sometimes we do very old stories. Today's story is from the 1870s. When I was a kid in the 1970s, my two favorite rides at Disneyland were Pirates of the Caribbean and The Haunted Mansion, and both of these rides were located, for some reason I didn't then understand, in the New Orleans part of Disneyland. I'm sure there were plenty of reasons for that, but one of the reasons is probably this story. The title of this story is called Jeannin Poquelin, and it is by George Washington Cable. In the first decade of the present century, when the newly established American government was the most hateful thing in Louisiana, when the Anglo-American flood that was presently to burst in a crevasse of immigration upon the Delta had thus far been felt only as a slippery seepage which made the Creole tremble for his footing, there stood a short distance above what is now Canal Street and considerably back from the line of villas which fringed the riverbank on Chapatoulas Road, an old colonial plantation house half in ruin. It stood aloof from civilization, the tracts that had once been its indigo fields given over to their first noxious wildness and grown up into one of the horridest marshes within a circuit of 50 miles. The house was of heavy cypress, lifted up on pillars, grim, solid, and spiritless. Its dark, weather-beaten roof and sides were hoisted up above the jungly plain in a distracted way, like a gigantic ammunition wagon stuck in the mud and abandoned by some retreating army. Around it was a dense growth of low water willows with half a hundred sorts of thorny or fetid bushes. They were hung with countless strands of discolored and prickly smilax, and the impassable mud below bristled with dwarf palmetto. Two lone forest trees, dead cypresses, stood in the center of the marsh, dotted with roosting vultures. The shallow strips of water were hid by myriads of aquatic plants under whose coarse and spiritless flowers, could one have seen it, was a harbor of reptiles, great and small, to make one shudder to the end of his days. The house was on a slightly raised spot, the levee of a draining canal. The waters of this canal did not run, they crawled, and were full of big ravening fish and alligators that held it against all comers. Such was the home of old Jean-Marie Poquelin. Once an opulent indigo planter, standing high in the esteem of his small, proud circle of exclusively male acquaintances in the old city, now a hermit, alike shunned by and shunning all who had ever known him. The last of his line, said the gossips. His father lies under the floor of the San Luis Cathedral, with his wife of his youth on one side and the wife of his old age on the other. Old Jean visits the spot daily. His half-brother, well, alas, there was a mystery. No one knew what had become of the gentle young half-brother, more than 30 years his junior, whom he once seemed so fondly to love, but who 7 years ago had disappeared suddenly, once for all, and left no clue of his fate. They had seemed to live so happily in each other's love. No father, mother, wife to either, no kindred upon earth. The elder, a bold, frank, impetuous, chivalric adventurer. The younger, a gentle, studious, book-loving recluse. They lived upon the ancestral estate like mated birds, one always on the wing, the other always in the nest. There was no trait in Jean-Marie Poquelin, said the old gossips, for which he was so well known among his few friends as his apparent fondness for his little brother. Jacques said this, and Jacques said that, and he would leave this or that or anything to Jacques, for Jacques was a scholar, and Jacques was good or wise or just or far-sighted, as the nature of the case required. And he should ask Jacques as soon as he got home, since Jacques was never elsewhere to be seen. It was between the roving character of the one brother and the bookishness of the other that the estate fell into decay. Jean-Marie, generous gentleman, gambled the slaves away one by one until none was left, man or woman, but one old African mute. The indigo fields and vats of Louisiana had been generally abandoned as unremunerative. Certain enterprising men had substituted the culture of sugar, but Jean Poquelin saw larger and at the time equally respectable profits, first in smuggling and later in the African slave trade. What harm could he see in it? The whole people said it was vitally necessary, and to minister to a vital public necessity, good enough, certainly. And so he laid up many a doubloon that made him none the worse in the public regard. One day, old Jean-Marie was about to start upon a voyage that was to be longer, much longer, than any he had yet made. Jacques had begged him hard for many days not to go, but he laughed him off and finally said, kissing him, "Adieu, petit frère." "No," said Jacques, "I shall go with you." They left the old hulk of a house in the sole care of the African mute and went away to the Guinea coast together. 2 years after, old Poquelin came home without his vessel. He must have arrived at his house by night. No one saw him come. No one saw his little brother, though rumor whispered that he too had returned, but he'd never been seen again. A dark suspicion fell upon the old slave trader. You know he has a quick and fearful temper, and why does he cover his loss with mystery? Grief would out with the truth. But, said the charitable few, look at his face. See that expression of true humanity. Now the many did look at his face, and as he looked in theirs, he read the silent question, "Where is thy brother, Abel?" The few were silenced. His former friends died off, and the name of Jean-Marie Poquelin became a symbol of witchery, devilish crime, and hideous nursery fictions. The man and his house were alike shunned. The snipe and duck hunters forsook the marsh, and the woodcutters abandoned the canal. Sometimes the hardier boys who ventured out there snake shooting heard a slow thumping of oarlocks on the canal, and they would look at each other for a moment, half in consternation and half in glee, and then rush from their sport in wanton haste to assail with their jibes the unoffending withered old man who in rusty attire sat in the stern of a skiff, rowed homeward by his white-headed African mute. "Oh, Jeanne, Poquelin, Jeanne, Jeanne, Poquelin!" While they tumbled one over another in their needless haste to fly, he would rise carefully from his seat while the aged mute with downcast face went on rowing, and rolling up his brown fist and extending it toward the urchins would pour forth such an unholy broadside of French imprecation and invective as would all but craze them with delight. Among both blacks and whites, the house was the object of 1,000 superstitions. Every midnight, they affirmed, the feu follet came out of the marsh and ran in and out of the rooms, flashing from window to window. The story of some lads, whose words in ordinary statements were worthless, was generally credited that the night they camped in the woods, rather than past the place after dark, they saw, about sunset, every window blood red, and on each of the 4 chimneys an owl sitting, which turned his head 3 times round and moaned and laughed with a human voice. And there was a bottomless well, everybody professed to know, beneath the sill of the big front door under the rotten veranda, and whoever set his foot upon that threshold disappeared forever into the depth below. Well, what wonder the marsh grew as wild as Africa. Take all the Faubourg Saint-Marie and half the ancient city, and you would find not one graceless daredevil reckless enough to pass within 100 yards of the house after nightfall. The alien races pouring into old New Orleans began to find the few streets named for the Bourbon princes too confining. Fields became roads, roads, streets, and everywhere the leveler was peering through his glass, rodsmen were whacking their way through willow brakes and rose hedges, and the sweating Irishmen tossed the blue clay up with their long-handled shovels. "Ah, that is very well," quoth the Creole, "but wait till they come yonder to Jean Pouquelin's marsh. The supposed predicament so delighted them that they laughed till the tears ran. For whether the street makers mired in the marsh or contrived to cut through old Jeannat's property, either event would be joyful. Meantime, a line of tiny rods with bits of white paper in their split tops gradually extended its way straight through the haunted ground and across the canal diagonally. "We shall fill that ditch," said the men in mud boots, and brushed close along the chained and padlocked gate of the haunted mansion. Ah, Jeannat Pouquelin, these were not Creole boys to be stampeded with a little harsh swearing. He went to the governor. That official scanned the odd figure with no slight interest. Jean Pouquelin was of short, broad frame, with a bronzed, leonine face. His brow was ample and deeply furrowed. His eye, large and black, was bold and open like that of a war horse, and his jaws shut together with a firmness of iron. His shirt, unbuttoned and thrown back from the throat and bosom sailor-wise, showed a Herculean breast, hard and grizzled. But there was no fierceness or defiance in his look, no harsh ungentleness, but rather a peaceful and peaceable fearlessness. Across the whole face, not marked in one or another feature, but as it were laid softly upon the countenance like an almost imperceptible veil, was the imprint of some great grief. A careless eye might easily overlook it, but once seen, there it hung, faint but unmistakable. The governor bowed. "Parlez-vous français?" asked the figure. "I would rather talk English, if you can do so," said the governor. "My name, Jean Pouquelin." "How can I serve you, Mr. Pouquelin?" "My house is yonder, dans le marais, là-bas." The governor bowed. "That marais belongs to me."
"Yes, sir."
"To me, Jean Pouquelin. I own him myself."
"Well, sir?"
"It don't belong to you. I get him from my father."
"Well, that is perfectly true, Mr. Pouquelin, as far as I'm aware."
"You want to make street pass yonde?"
"Well, I don't know, sir. It is quite probable, but the city will indemnify you for any loss that you may suffer. You will be paid, you understand?"
"Street can't pass there."
"Well, you will have to see the municipal authorities about that, Mr. Pouquelin."
A bitter smile came upon the old man's face.
"Pardon, monsieur, you is not le gouverneur?"
"Yes."
"Yes, you are le gouverneur. Yes, very well. I come to you, I tell you, street can't pass at my house."
"Have a chair, Mr. Pouquelin." But the old man did not stir. The governor took a quill and wrote a line to a city official introducing Mr. Pouquelin and asking from him every possible courtesy. He handed it to him, instructing him where to present it. "Mr. Pouquelin," he said with a conciliatory smile, "tell me, is it your house that our Creole citizens tell such odd stories about?" The old man glared sternly upon the speaker and with immovable features said,
"You don't see me trade some Guinea slave?"
"Oh, no."
"You don't see me make some smuggling?"
"Oh, no, sir, not at all."
"But I am Jean-Marie Pouquelin. I mind my own business. That's all right. Adieu."
And he put on his hat and withdrew. By and by he stood, letter in hand, before the person to whom it was addressed. This person employed an interpreter.
"It says," said the interpreter to the officer, "he come to make fair warning that you must not make the street pass at his house."
The officer remarked that such impudence was refreshing, but the experienced interpreter translated freely.
"He says, what do you want?" said the interpreter.
The old slave trader answered at some length.
It says, said the interpreter, again turning to the officer, the morass is too unhealthy for people to live.
But we expect to drain his old marsh. It's not going to be a marsh.
The old man answered tersely.
It says the canal is private, said the interpreter.
That old ditch? Well, that's to be filled up. Tell the old man, we're going to fix him up nicely.
Translation being duly made, the man in power was amused to see a thundercloud gathering on the old man's face.
Tell him, he added, by the time we finish, there'll not be a ghost left in his shanty.
The interpreter began to translate, but Je comprends, said the old man with an impatient gesture, and burst forth pouring curses upon the United States, the President, the Territory of Orleans, Congress, the Governor, and all his subordinates, striding out of the apartment as he cursed.
Why, it'll make his old place worth $10 to $1, said the official to the interpreter.
"'Tis not for the worth of the property, said the interpreter.
Well, I should guess not, said the other. It seems to me as if some of these old Creoles would leave or live in a crawfish hole than to have a neighbor.
You know what make old Jean Poquelin make like that? I would tell you, he said in a solemn whisper. He is a witch.
Some months passed, and the street was opened. A canal was first dug through the marsh. The small one, which passed so close to Jean Poquelin's house, was filled, and the street, or rather a sunny road, just touched a corner of the old mansion's dooryard. The morass ran dry. Its venomous denizens slipped away through the bulrushes. The cattle, roaming freely upon its hardened surface, trampled the superabundant undergrowth. And one by one of the dead cypresses, a giant creeper hung its green burden of foliage and lifted its scarlet trumpets. Sparrows and redbirds flitted through the bushes, and dewberries grew ripe beneath. And over all these came a sweet, dry smell of salubrity, which the place had not known since the sediments of the Mississippi first lifted it from the sea. And over the willow brakes, and down the vista of the open street, bright new houses, some singly, some by ranks, were prying in upon the old man's privacy. They even settled down toward his southern side, first a woodcutter's hut or two, then a market gardener's shanty, then a painted cottage, and all at once the faubourg had flanked and half-surrounded him and his dried-up marsh. Then the common people began to hate him. The old tyrant! What does he live in that unneighborly way for? The old pirate? The old kidnapper? There he goes with the boys after him. Ha ha, Jeanne Poquelin, Jeanne! How merrily the swarming Americans echoed the spirit of persecution. The old fraud, they said, he pretends to live in a haunted house, does he? Well, we'll tar and feather him someday. Guess we can fix him. He cannot be rowed home along the old canal now. He walks. He has broken sadly of late, and the street urchins are ever at his heels. To the Creoles, to the incoming lower classes of superstitious Germans, Irish, Sicilians, and others, he became an omen and embodiment of public and private ill fortune. Upon him all the vagaries of their superstitions gathered and grew. If a house caught fire, it was imputed to his machinations. Did a woman go off in a fit? He had bewitched her. Did a child stray off for an hour? The mother shivered with the apprehension that Jean Poquelin had offered him to strange gods. The house was the subject of every bad boy's invention. As long as that house stands, we'll have bad luck. He keeps a fetish. He's conjured up the whole Faubourg Saint-Marie. A building and improvement company, which had not yet got its charter, but was going to, and which had not indeed any tangible capital yet, but was going to have some, joined in the Jean Poquelin war. The haunted property would be such a capital site for a market house. They sent a deputation to the old mansion to ask its occupant to sell. Well, the deputation never got beyond the chained gate and a very barren interview with the African mute. One of the board said, Mr. President, this market house project, as I take it, is not altogether a selfish one. The community is to be benefited by it. We may feel that we are working in the public interest. The board smiled knowingly. If we employ all possible means to oust this old nuisance from among us. Now, you may know that at the time the street was cut through, this old Pokeyland did all he could to prevent it.
It was owing to a certain connection which I had with that affair that I heard a ghost story, which, of course, I'm not going to relate. But I may say that my profound conviction arising from a prolonged study of that story is that this old villain, Jean Poquelin, has his brother locked up in that old house. Now, if this is so, and we can fix it on him, I merely suggest that we can make the matter highly useful. I don't know, he added, beginning to sit down, but that it is an action we owe to the community. How do you propose to handle the subject? Asked the president.
I was thinking, said the speaker, that, well, as the board of directors, it would be unadvisable for us to authorize any action involving trespass. But if you, for instance, Mr. President, should, as it were, for mere curiosity, request someone as, for instance, our excellent secretary, simply as a personal favor to look into the matter, well, it's merely a suggestion.
The secretary smiled sufficiently to be understood that, while he certainly did not consider such preposterous service a part of his duties as secretary, he might, notwithstanding, accede to the president's request, and the board adjourned. Little White, as the secretary was called, was a mild, kind-hearted little man who, nevertheless, had no fear of anything, unless it was the fear of being unkind. I tell you frankly, he privately said to the president, that I go into this purely for reasons of my own. The next day, a little after nightfall, one might have descried this little man slipping along the rear fence of the Poquelin place, preparatory to vaulting over into the rank, grass-grown yard. The picture presented to his eye was not calculated to enliven his mind. The old mansion stood out against the western sky, black and silent. One long, lurid pencil stroke along a sky of slate was all that was left of daylight. No sign of life was apparent, no light in any window. No owls were on the chimneys, no dogs were in the yard. He entered the place and ventured up behind a small cabin which stood apart from the house. Through one of its many crannies, he easily detected the African mute, crouched, his head on his knees, fast asleep. He concluded to enter the mansion and, with that view, stood and scanned it. The broad rear steps of the veranda would not serve him. He might meet someone midway. He was measuring with his eye the proportions of one of the pillars which supported it and estimating the practicability of climbing it when he heard a footstep. Someone dragged a chair out toward the railing, then seemed to change his mind and began to pace the veranda, his footfalls resounding on the dry boards with singular loudness. Little White at once recognized the short, broad-shouldered form of old Jean Poquelin. He sat there but a moment when he noticed a strange, sickening odor, faint, as if coming from a distance, but loathsome and horrid. Whence could it come? Not from the marsh, for it was dry as powder. It was not in the air. It seemed to come from the ground. Rising up, he noticed for the first time, a few steps before him, a narrow footpath leading toward the house. He glanced down it. Right there was someone coming. Ghostly White. Quick as thought and as noiselessly, he lay down at full length. It was bold strategy, and yet there was no denying it. Little White felt that he was frightened. It is not a ghost, he said to himself. I know it cannot be a ghost. But the perspiration burst out at every pore, and the air seemed to thicken with heat. It is a living man, he said in his thoughts. I hear his footstep, and I hear old Poquelin's footsteps, too, separately over on the veranda. Oh, there's that odor again. What a smell of death! It is in the path again, he shuddered. Well, now, if I dare venture, the mystery is solved. He rose cautiously and peered along the path. The figure of a man, a presence if not a body, but whether clad in some white stuff or naked, the darkness would not allow him to determine, had turned and now, with a seeming painful gait, moved slowly from him. Oh, great heaven, can it be that the dead do walk? He withdrew again the hands which had gone to his eyes. The dreadful object passed between two pillars and under the house. He listened. There was a faint sound as of feet upon the staircase. Then all was still. The little secretary was about to retreat. But as he looked once more toward the haunted house, a dim light appeared in the crack of a closed window, and presently old Jean Poquelin came, dragging his chair, and sat down close against the shining cranny. He spoke in a low, tender tone, in the French tongue, making some inquiry, and an answer came from within. Was it the voice of a human? So unnatural was it, so hollow, so discordant, so unearthly, that the stealthy listener shuddered again from head to foot, and when something stirred in the bushes nearby, though it may only have been a rat, and came scuttling through the grass, the little secretary actually turned and fled. As he left the enclosure, he moved with bolder leisure through the bushes, and yet now and then he spoke aloud, "Oh, oh, I see. I understand." And he shut his eyes in his hands. How strange that henceforth Little White was the champion of Jean Poquelin. In season and out of season, wherever a word was uttered against him, the secretary, with a quiet, aggressive force that instantly arrested gossip, demanded upon what authority the statement or conjecture was made. But he did not condescend to explain his own remarkable attitude. It was not long before the disrelish and suspicion which had followed Jean Poquelin so many years fell also upon him. It was only the next evening but one after his adventure that he made himself a source of sullen amazement to 150 boys by ordering them to desist from their wanton hallooing. Old Jean Poquelin, standing and shaking his cane, rolling out his long-drawn maledictions, paused and stared, and then gave the secretary a courteous bow and started on, and the boys, save one, from pure astonishment ceased. But a ruffianly little Irish lad, more daring than any had yet been, threw a big hurtling clod that struck old Poquelin between the shoulders and burst like a shell. The enraged old man wheeled with uplifted staff to give chase to the scampering vagabond, and, well, he may have tripped or he may not, but he fell full length. Little White hastened to help him up, but he waved him off with a fierce imprecation and, staggering to his feet, resumed his way homeward. His lips were reddened with blood. Little White was on his way to the meeting of the board. He would have given all he dared spend to have stayed away, for he felt both too fierce and too tremulous to brook the criticisms that were likely to be made. "I can't help it, gentlemen. I can't help you to make the case against the old man, and I'm not going to." "We did not expect this disappointment, Mr. White." "I can't help that, sir. No, sir. You better not appoint any more investigations. Somebody will investigate him into trouble." "No, sir, it isn't a threat. It's only my advice. But I warn you that whoever takes this task in hand will rue it to his dying day, which may be hastened, too." The president expressed himself surprised. "Well, I don't care a rush," answered Little White, wildly and foolishly. "I don't care a rush if you do, sir. No, my nerves are not disordered. My head's as clear as a bell. No, I am not excited." A director remarked that the secretary looked as though he'd waked from a nightmare. "Well, sir, if you want to know the fact, I have. And if you choose to cultivate old Poquelin's society, you can have one, too." "White," called a facetious member, but White did not notice. "White," he called again. "What?" demanded White with a scowl. "Did you see a ghost?" "Yes, sir, I did," cried White, hitting the table and handing the president a paper which brought the board to other business. The story got among the gossips that somebody, they were afraid to say Little White, had been to the Poquelin mansion by night and beheld something appalling. The rumor was but a shadow of the truth, magnified and distorted, as is the manner of shadows. He had seen skeletons walking. He'd barely escaped the clutches of one by making the sign of the cross. "If that old rascal lived in the country we come from," said certain Americans, "he'd have been tarred and feathered before now, wouldn't he, Sanders?"
"Well, now he just would.
And we'd have ridden him out on a rail, wouldn't we?"
"That's what I allow."
"Well, I tell you what we could do." They were talking to some rollicking Creoles who had assumed an absolute necessity for doing something. "What is this, what you call this thing where an old man marries a young girl and you come out with horns and charivari?" asked the Creole.
"Yeah, that's it.
Why don't you shivery him?" Felicitous suggestion. Little White and his wife beside him were sitting on their doorstep on the sidewalk, looking toward the sunset. They had moved into the lately open street. The view was not attractive on the score of beauty. The houses were small and scattered, and across the flat commons, spite of the lofty tangle of weeds and bushes, and spite of the thickets of acacia, they need must see the dismal old Poquelin mansion tilted awry and shutting out the declining sun. The moon, white and slender, was hanging the tip of its horn over one of the chimneys.
"And you say," said the secretary, "the old black man has been going by here alone? Well, Paddy, suppose old Poquelin should be concocting some mischief. He don't lack provocation. And the way that clod hit him the other day was enough to have killed him. Why, Paddy, he dropped as quick as that. Well, it's no wonder we haven't seen him. They say that the boys are going to shivery old Poquelin tonight. I'm going to try and stop it."
"Why, White," said his wife, "you better not. You'll get hurt."
"No, I'll not. Yes, you will. I'm going to sit out here until they come along. They are compelled to pass right by here."
"Why, White, it may be midnight before they start. You're not going to sit out here till then."
"Yes, I am."
"Well, you're very foolish," said Mrs. White in an undertone, looking anxious and tapping one of the steps with her foot. They sat a very long time talking over little family matters.
"Paddy, suppose I walk out to that house and see if I find out anything."
"Suppose," said she, "you don't do any such—"
"Listen."
Down the street arose a great hubbub. Dogs and boys were howling and barking. Men were laughing, shouting, groaning, and blowing horns, whooping and clanking cowbells, whinnying and howling and rattling pots and pans.
"They're coming this way," said Little White. You better get into the house, Paddy."
"So had you."
"No, I'm going to see if I can stop them."
"Why, White,
I'll be back in a minute," said White.
And he went toward the noise. In a few moments, the little secretary met the mob. Little White lifted his ineffectual voice. He faced the head of the disorderly column and cast himself about as if he were made of wood and moved by the jerk of a string. He rushed to one who seemed, from the size and clatter of his tin pan, to be a leader.
"Stop these fellows, Bienvenu! Stop them just a minute till I tell them something!"
Bienvenu turned and brandished his instruments of discord in an imploring way to the crowd. The throng halted.
"Bienvenu," said Little White, "don't shivery old Poquelin tonight. He's—"
"Ma foi," said the swaying Bienvenu. "Who tell you I'm going to shivery somebody, huh? You think because I make a little playful with this tin pan that I am drunk?"
"Oh, no, Bienvenu, old fellow. You're all right. I was afraid that you might not know that old Poquelin was sick, you know. But, well, you're not going there, are you?"
"Ma foi, I'm very sorry to tell you that you're drunk as the devil. I'm ashamed of you. I am the servant of the public. These citoyens are going to request Jean Poquelin to give to the Ursuline $250.
Huh? "Et quoi?" cried a listener. "500 piastres, ouais."
"Ouais," cried Bienvenu. "And if he refuses, we'll make him some little music. Ha!"
And he hoisted a merry hand and foot, and then frowning added,
"Oh, Poquelin, you got no business drink so much whiskey."
"But gentlemen," said Little White, around whom a circle had gathered, "the old man is very sick."
"Ma faith," cried a tiny Creole, "we did not make him to be sick. When we say we're going to make le charivari, you want to say we are tell a lie?"
"But you can shivery somebody else," said desperate Little White.
"Oui," cried Bienvenu, "et charivari Jean Poquelin tomorrow."
"Let us go to Madame Schneider," cried two or three, and amid huzzas and confused cries, among which was heard a stentorian Celtic call for drinks, the crowd again began to move.
500 piastres pour l'hôpital de charité. Hurrah! $100 for charity hospital. Ah!"
Bang went the tin pan, and the crowd yelled, and pandemonium gaped again, and they went off at a right angle.
Nodding, Mrs. White looked at the mantel clock. The hideous noise down on the street was passing beyond earshot. She raised the sash and listened. For a moment there was silence, and someone came to the door.
"Is it you, White?"
"Yes," he entered.
"I succeeded, Paddy."
"Did you?" said Patty joyfully. Yes, they had gone down to Chivalry, the old Dutch woman who married her stepdaughter's sweetheart. They say she's got to pay $100 to the hospital before they stop. And the couple retired, and Mrs. White slumbered. She was awakened by her husband snapping the lid of his watch. What time, she asked.
3:30, Patty. I haven't slept a wink. Those fellows are out yet. Don't you hear them?
Why, White, they're coming this way.
I know they are, said White, sliding out of bed and drawing on his clothes, and they're coming fast. You better go away from that window, Patty. Oh, my, what a clatter.
Here they are, said Mrs. White. But her husband was gone.
200 or 300 men and boys passed the place at a rapid walk straight down the broad new street toward the hated house of ghosts. The din was terrific. She saw little White at the head of the rabble, brandishing his arms and trying in vain to make himself heard, but they only shook their heads, laughing and hooting the louder, and so passed, bearing him on before them. Swiftly they pass out from among the houses, away from the dim oil lamps of the street, out into the broad starlit commons, and enter the willowy jungles of the haunted ground. Some hearts fail, and their owners lag behind and turn back, suddenly remembering how near morning it is. But the most part push on, tearing the air with their clamor. Down ahead of them in the long, thicket-darkening way, there is, singularly enough, a faint, dancing light. It must be very near the old house. It is. It has stopped now. It is a lantern and is under a well-known sapling which has grown up upon the wayside since the canal was filled. Now it swings mysteriously to and fro. A goodly number of the more ghost-fearing give up the sport. But a 100 move forward at a run, doubling their devilish howling and banging. Yes, it is a lantern, and there are 2 persons under the tree. The crowd draws near, drops into a walk. One of the 2 is the old African mute. He lifts the lantern up so that it shines on the other. The crowd recoils. There is a hush of all the clangor, and all at once, with a cry of mingled fright and horror from every throat, the whole throng rushes back, dropping everything, sweeping past little White and hurrying on, never stopping until the jungle is left behind. And then to find that not 1 in 10 has seen the cause of the stampede, and not 1 of the 10th is certain what it was. There is 1 huge fellow among them who looks capable of any villainy. He finds something to mount on, and in the Creole patois calls a general halt. Bienvenue sinks down and vainly, trying to recline gracefully, resigns the leadership. And the herd gather around the speaker. He assures them that they've been outraged. Their right peaceably to traverse the public streets has been trampled upon. Shall such encroachments be endured? It is now daybreak. Let them go now by the open light of day and force a free passage of the public highway. A scattering consent was the response, and the crowd, thinned now and drowsy, straggled quietly down toward the old house. Some drifted ahead, others sauntered behind, but everyone, as he again neared the tree, came to a standstill. Little White sat upon the bank of turf on the opposite side of the way, looking very stern and sad. To each newcomer, he put the same question. Did you come here to go to old Poquelin's?
Yes.
He's dead. And if the shocked hearer started away, he would say, don't go away. Why not? I want you to go to the funeral presently. And if some Louisianian too loyal to dear France or Spain to understand English looked bewildered, someone would interpret for him, and presently they went. Little White led the van, and the crowd trooped after him down the middle of the way. The gate, that had never been seen before unchained, was open. Stern Little White stopped a short distance from it, and the rabble stopped behind him. Something was moving out from under the veranda. The many whisperers stretched upward to see. The African mute came very slowly toward the gate, leading by a cord in the nose a small brown bull, which was harnessed to a rude cart. And on the flat body of the cart, under a black cloth, were seen the outlines of a long box.
Hats off, gentlemen, said Little White,
as the box came in view and the crowd silently uncovered. "Gentlemen," said Little White, "here come the last remains of Jean-Marie Poquelin. A better man, I'm afraid, with all his sins. Yes, a better. A kinder man to his blood. A man of more self-forgetful goodness than all of you put together will ever dare to be." There was a profound hush as the vehicle came creaking through the gate. But when it turned away from them toward the forest, those in front started suddenly. There was a backward rush, and then all stood still again, staring one way. For there, behind the bier, with eyes cast down and labored step, walked the living remains, all that was left of little Jacques Poquelin, the long-hidden brother, a leper as white as snow. Dumb with horror, the cringing crowd gazed upon the walking death. They watched in silent awe the slow cortege creep down the long straight road and lessen on the view until by and by it stopped where a wild unfrequented path branched off into the undergrowth toward the rear of the ancient city.
"They are going to the Terre aux Lepreux," said one of the crowd,
and the rest watched them in silence. When the little bull was set free, the mute, with the strength of an ape, lifted the long box to his shoulder. For a moment more, the mute and the leper stood in sight, while the former adjusted his heavy burden, and then, without one backward glance upon the unkind human world, turning their faces toward the ridge in the depths of the swamp known as the Leper's Land, they stepped into the jungle, disappeared, and were never seen again. The end. Thank you for coming.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.